Iran's leader says that events marking the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani proved that his martyrdom only promoted his campaign. Russia rules out any concession to the U.S. in talks on Ukraine, saying it's disappointed over signals coming from Washington ahead of the negotiations. And Kazakhstan says Russian-led peacekeepers are protecting its strategic sites as it arrests nearly 6,000 people in connection with an ongoing unrest. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the United States' assassination of Lieutenant General Soleimani has only further strengthened the campaign that the anti-terror commander set in motion. The leader said that Washington's miscalculations have resulted in the U.S. government making wrong decisions, which in turn have led to its failure. Also, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the U.S.'s profound animosity toward the Islamic Republic emanates from the religious nature of Iran's establishment. According to him, tyrants have always been opposed to movements and establishments with a religious foundation. The leader delivered that speech on the anniversary of the 1978 uprising in Iran against the dictatorial rule of the Pahlavi monarch. Now, we've talked to public analyst Mustafa Khoshchesh. Let's listen to him explain how the U.S. power in the region has been on the way since General Soleimani's assassination.
After assassination of Haj Qasem Soleimani, the lieutenant general and anti-terror commander, we have been witnessing a different situation. The number of attacks by the resistant forces on the U.S. troops in the region have, you know, increased, and also the U.S. has started a very confusing withdrawal from this region. The U.S. demise has sped up. We all saw how they exited and escaped, actually, Afghanistan, and the time has arrived for their expulsion from Iraq. The U.S. troops have come under more and more attacks in Iraq, and they have also withdrawn from some bases in Qatar. They withdrew the top echelon of the CENTCOM from Doha, and it's very clear that the U.S. is growingly becoming weaker and weaker each day, and this has been somehow the impact of his of the assassination of Qasem Soleimani.
Iran has added 51 American individuals to its terror blacklist for involvement in the assassination of the country's top General Soleimani and his companions. A short time ago, we've discussed that issue in our news review program.
Tehran has updated its list of American individuals blacklisted for involvement in the assassination of Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and his companions. Iran's foreign ministry announced it's added 51 of U.S. officials to that list. It said that Washington acted in glorification of terrorism and violation of fundamental human rights by conducting, quote, this callous terrorist act. Ministry vowed heinous terrorist act will not diminish the resolute determination of Iran in following the path of General Soleimani in fighting terror. On January 3, 2020, U.S. assassinated Soleimani and his companions, including senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a drone strike just outside of Baghdad's international airport. Joining us now for the news review program is Sarah Flounders, co-director at International Action Center from New York, and John Philpott, international lawyer at the ICC, joining us from Montreal, Canada. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start with you, Ms. Flounders. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in New York. Having this blacklist of that, would like to tune in to this our website to see the comprehensive list of all the names, including the Boltons and the Trumps and the Pompeos and the Nikki Haleys, and along with everyone else that basically conspired to carry out this assassination, and then post-fact try to justify this attack on General Soleimani and his companions. Ms. Flounders, this list, obviously we know that Iran does not have the access to the kind of justice that it wishes to get on the international level, or does it, in your point of view? But nevertheless, what kind of impact do you think this kind of list will have as far as possibly preventing a similar act in the future?
Well, it's very important, even if Iran has no way of implementing at this time this list of those responsible for terrorism. Naming names is important, and not allowing Commander Soleimani to be forgotten, to just let this go, but to continue to both raise his name and his involvement in both organizing resistance and peace in the region, and cooperation among those who are really attempting to resist U.S. imperialism in the region. That's a big contribution. So refusing to allow his name to be forgotten, and at the same time naming the names of those who are directly responsible. And this list has grown. Last year, Iran announced 8 officials, and this year, the 51 officials, which it shows every policy has a whole list of people who put it into immediate practice. But most important is that President Trump, Bolton, Pompeo, and so on are right at the top, because that's who ordered this strike, this assassination, this terrorist act. And that should be remembered, and there should be a demand put forth to the world that they be prosecuted and brought to justice. So the sanctions are an important political step.
Thank you, ma'am. And Mr. John Philpott, welcome to the program, sir. Your thoughts on what kind of impact, compiling such a list may have of those complicit in the assassination of General Soleimani, the most highly decorated general, I should add, at the time, in Iran's armed forces?
Well, it's very appropriate, and you can be sure that if it happened the other way around, they would have everybody named, and they'd be trying to extradite them from anywhere in the world. And we think of the case of Alex Saab, who did nothing and has been transferred to the U.S. from Cape Verde. So it's extremely important. And you've got to remember, or we have to remember, when you murder somebody in another country, you're liable for it. It is a crime. It's a terrorist crime. It's a murder. It's war of aggression. And I understand Iran has a treaty with Iraq that they can charge people for that killing of General Soleimani, a hero. We all knew about him back from the 80s when he was working defending Iran. And the U.S. come up with all kinds of silly, silly defenses, self-defense from anticipated attack. There's nothing to that. And so I think that some American officials are going to be frightened of traveling abroad. And the world is changing. Arrest warrants stay on the books, and these people should be brought to justice, and they can make their defenses. They can defend themselves in Iranian courts. Maybe some of their defenses are valid. I don't know. But Iran has the right to charge these people and apply Iranian criminal law. I don't know whether it has the death penalty or not. I think it probably does, but serious detention. And so that is a step forward, which it's kind of a tit-for-tat thing, but it is right, and it's right in international law.
Thank you for joining us on the program here, Mr.
Thank you.
You bet. John Philpott there joining us from Montreal, and Sarah Flounders joining us out of New York. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. Iranian Foreign Minister says that reaching a good agreement is possible in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna if the Western side shows necessary goodwill and determination. Hossein Amir Abdullahian noted that Iran has the necessary determination to achieve an agreement through goodwill. He made a comment in a phone conversation with his Indian counterpart. Meantime, Iran's top negotiator says the participants in the Vienna talks are heading forward and making progress. Ali Bagherekian says differences among the parties are narrowing, and this while the other sides have also voiced optimism about the pace of the negotiations. Earlier, we were joined by our Vienna correspondent, Homa Lazghi, and she offered us the update about the Iran P4 plus one talks there.
We just had a tweet from the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, the main source of the news, mostly from these talks on Twitter. And he said that at the end of today, there's been another, in his words, traditional meeting between the 4+1, the remaining signatories of the JCPOA minus Iran and the U.S. delegation, during which, in the words of Mr. Olyanov, the difficult issue of guarantees of a non-repetition of recent problems, he says, was discussed, and he said that the Russian delegation had presented a number of suggestions in this regard. We know, of course, that the issue of guarantees and verification when it comes to the U.S. sanctions removal is of key importance for the Iranian delegation led by Mr. Bagherekian. Now, going back to the two important issues of guarantees and verification, what Iran has asked for since the beginning of these negotiations, basically, to restore the JCPOA, has been that it wants enough guarantees to be able to get an assurance that the U.S. Will not withdraw from the JCPOA again without Iran being able to benefit from the deal effectively. So it says that it will only go back to its commitment after the verified and effective removal of U.S. sanctions. It wants guarantees that the U.S. will not impose any additional sanctions once the deal is restored that would violate the JCPOA or that would impede its implementation.
In other news, the Syrian army intercepts a U.S. military convoy in the Hasaka countryside in the northeastern corner of the country, forcing them to retreat. According to Syrian media, the convoy of four armored vehicles was driven out of a village north of the town of Tal Tamer. The U.S. military has stationed troops and equipment in the eastern and northeastern parts of Syria. The Pentagon claims the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into Daesh terrorist hands. Damascus, however, says that the unlawful deployment violates Syrian sovereignty and is meant to plunder the country's resources. Now, soon, senior diplomats from the U.S. and Russia will be sitting down for talks on issues straining their bilateral relations. But even before the meeting, both sides are voicing optimism. Russian envoy Sergei Ryabkov says that he's disappointed by the signals that the U.S. and the European Union are sending before the talks in Geneva. He says that the United States is insisting on getting unilateral concessions from Russia, but that Moscow will not agree to any such concession. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also saying that many of Moscow's proposals are simply non-starters. The Kremlin is seeking a new security agreement with the White House. The dispute over Ukraine will top the agenda. Also, arms control, human rights, and conflicts around the globe will likely be brought up. The talks will be held on Sunday and Monday. A Russia-NATO meeting is scheduled for Wednesday. Now, Kazakhstan saying that Russian-led peacekeepers are now protecting several of its strategic facilities, so while the country is struggling to contain the deadliest violence in its 30-year history. A Russia-led regional security organization has sent troops into the country to bring back order at the president's request. The presidential office says that 5,800 people have been arrested, many of them foreign citizens. The former prime minister and former intelligence chief are also in detention, and suspicion of treason and a state of emergency is in place. The turmoil has killed dozens, including police officers, over the past week. The government says that things have now stabilized through counter-terror operations continue. Some small cities are still witnessing protests. The chaos broke out over a hike in fuel prices, but protests continued even after the government resigned and the president restored fuel price caps. Now, protests against COVID restrictions once again hitting Europe amid an explosion in the number of infections there. Now, just in France, 100,000 people turned out in Paris and other cities to voice their anger. The government plans to further restrict the unvaccinated are drawing much criticism. Once approved by the Senate, the new law will require everyone above 12 to to show their vaccine passes while entering a restaurant, using public transport, or attending an event. A negative test will no longer be enough. Similar protests were held in Italy and Germany. Some countries in Europe have been reporting record infections, mostly blamed on Omicron. France has reported some 300,000 cases. Britain, Italy, and Russia have also witnessed record numbers. Jerome Hughes says that there is a great deal of concern regarding the COVID situation in the European Union amid an Omicron-driven surge in infections.
There's no doubt, again, we use the word a lot, but there's a great deal of concern here in the European Union. And what the experts are saying is that they anticipate, just like we saw in the middle of January 2021, that in about a week's time, we're going to see a surge. We're going to see the results of large gatherings, people coming together during the holiday period. We saw it 12 months ago, and that's what they're predicting now in 7 days' time. So, you know, the true number of cases, actually, I mean, you talk about in Italy almost 200,000 new cases in a 24-hour period and more than 150,000 in Spain. But the true number of cases, of course, is expected to be much, much higher because different countries in the EU, the 27 countries, they have different capacities in terms of testing. So in terms of people having symptoms and trying to get a PCR test, in some countries it's relatively easy, in some countries it's very difficult. And also the availability of rapid antigen tests are also, that varies greatly across the EU as well, depending on the situation of the pandemic and how it's affecting the population. So, you know, the problem is, of course, Omicron is less deadly, but when you have, you know, the population here, 430 million people, you have almost 150 million adults who have not been vaccinated. But even, you know, with Omicron being less deadly, the more and more people it affects, even a small percentage of a huge number of people means that invariably that hospitals are going to be put under pressure.
Now, the Omicron variant is spreading like wildfire in many parts of the world, including in Mexico. The country is reporting more than 30,000 daily COVID infections, the highest since the beginning of the pandemic. Also, the death toll there has surpassed 300,000. Mexico is the world's fifth worst-hit country. Experts believe the figures are even much higher than the authorities announced. President López Obrador has acknowledged that a new tide is coming, but ruled out any nationwide restriction. Still, some states have closed schools again to curb the spread. That's a wrap for this broadcast from Tehran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Humanity is in need of Jesus Christ's teachings against oppression. Jesus Christ was equipped with the power of performing miracles and carried a divine message for humanity which saved them from the darkness of polytheism, atheism, ignorance, and oppression, and guided them towards justice, knowledge, and worshipping God. And this is the lesson which all Christians and Muslims who believe in the prophethood of Jesus Christ should learn. Today, humanity is in need of those teachings more than ever before. The Virgin Mary was a young woman who stood firm against the accusations and suspicions of the people in her town and region, and she returned to her people holding her son in her arms. A girl came to a temple and stayed there until her youth. What factors and motivations caused her to resist all those temptations with such superhuman power? If her power was not superhuman, the issue would not be so greatly emphasized in the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran says she guarded her chastity, which means that she remained pure.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Islam taught us to behave in a fair way towards the followers of other religions. January 26, 2015. We have learned from Islam that we should behave in a fair way towards the followers of other religions. This is Islam's command to us. Today, what is witnessed in the world is that powers of those governments which claim to support justice do not at all behave in a fair way, except in the inner circle of their narrow, limited, and oppressive policies. Today you can see that in Europe and America, they use massive propaganda against Muslims. The issue is not why Muslims do not have any freedom in many of these countries. Rather, the issue is why they do not have any security. The movie American Sniper, which has produced some reactions and which has been made by Hollywood, encourages a Christian or non-Muslim to harass Muslims as much as he can. In fact, according to what others have said, we have not seen this movie, it encourages such courses of action. This is not at all accepted by Islam. Islam believes in justice. On the issue of that attack on the city of Al-Anbar, the commander of the faithful, peace and greetings be upon him, said, "I have come to know that every one of them entered upon Muslim women and non-Muslim women." In this sermon, he says that some people have entered the houses of Muslims and Mu'ahida women. Mu'ahid means Jewish and Christian individuals who have formed an alliance with Muslims and who live under the protection of Islam, to take away their ornaments and harass them. Then Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "If any Muslim dies of grief after hearing all of this, he is not to be blamed." If a Muslim dies of grief at the harassment of non-Muslim women by the armies of the enemies and looters, they entered their houses and took away their ornaments, he is not to be blamed. This is the viewpoint of Islam.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
سید امین عالمی، کابل.
شهان بات، ایندین ادمنیسترد کشمیر.
Round the world with reporters.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Purizup, London.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Milo Ponsford, Jake Scoos, and Sage Willoughby, dubbed the Colston Four, celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
We illuminated history. Daylight, we illuminated history.
And this is a victory for Bristol. This is a victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the court accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General, asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars.
Women watchers to your station will be surprised to know you'll you can get longer for putting down a statue under the new provisions than you do for rape, which is absolutely bizarre. But it shows the extent to which this government is intent on pursuing culture wars and criminalising the Black Lives Matter movement.
There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston 4 trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's checkered past. But then again, maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days, but is finally breaking this fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity. Thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner. But the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceived the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts expressed shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence, with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American-Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witnessed that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stressed on the need of unity among Muslims and called on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the U.S. to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis, and all Muslims, because there has been so many. criminal activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the International Conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahl-e Bayt alayhi salam. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. Things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
We have declared earlier that the best revenge is the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. And over the past 2 years, as the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the U.S. has been forced to leave Afghanistan with humiliation. This has led the U.S. allies to rethink their alliance with Washington.
In an address to a ceremony in Beirut remembering the martyrs Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and their companions, Sayyid Nasrallah also accused the U.S. of being behind all Israeli and Saudi crimes in the region for decades.
The lesson which I would like to highlight today is that everyone acting for the sake of God emerges victorious in all battles and wins the hearts and minds of all people across the Arab and Muslim worlds. They show us that the U.S. serves as a real enemy and source of corruption, occupation, and terrorism in our region.
Analysts believe that the project of the resistance continues to face the criminality of the U.S. in Lebanon and the region.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani belongs to the school of thought of a struggle against the occupiers of our land and those who destroyed our homes and killed our people and led one war after the other with their support for the Zionists. He sacrificed his life and stood against terrorism in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon and Palestine. He taught us that Lebanon is strong enough and can remove itself from the U.S. hegemony.
The leader of the resistance stressed that the assassination of martyr Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has triggered a new phase at the regional level.
The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and PMU commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is seen as an incident larger than the region itself, and for many analysts has brought to light a long-term confrontation for Lebanon's Hezbollah facing U.S. influence in Lebanon and the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Caskets draped in Iranian flag contains the bodies of 150 Iranian soldiers whose remains have recently been found more than 3 decades after the end of the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. The mourning procession in Tehran is part of a larger national event which saw similar memorial services held for 100 more martyrs in 24 provinces across the country. The funerals were attended by Iranian military and state officials as well as thousands of Iranians to pay tribute to the martyrs and also to observe the second anniversary of the U.S.'s assassination of top Iranian military figure, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
We have returned, and now the people are greeting those martyrs who have sacrificed their lives. General Soleimani also was a personality who has sacrificed his life in order to maintain the security of our country. Now this is a coincidence with the second anniversary of martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, and now they have returned. As you can see, everyone is holding the picture of General Qasem Soleimani, and this shows a reminder of the job that General Soleimani has done for our country.
General Soleimani fought for the security of our country and the region. He pushed back the terrorists, and this made him as a popular figure in the region.
Lieutenant General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was assassinated in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Soleimani is highly revered in the region for his anti-terror efforts and his role in eradicating Daesh terrorists from Iraq in 2017.
General Soleimani spent all his life fighting for our security, once in the Iraq-Iran war and then in the fight against terrorism. The U.S. assassinated him because he did not allow the terrorists to take over the region. The U.S. was with the terrorists.
We are all Qasem Soleimani. The United States thought in vain that if it killed our general, it would disrupt his endeavors. But we all will keep his legacy alive.
General Soleimani began his career as a soldier in the IRGC in the Iraq-Iran war. While above 200,000 Iranians are estimated to have either lost their lives or gone missing during the war. Over the years, the country has been carrying out search operations to recover the remains of those missing.
The Islamic Republic always holds such mass ceremonies to honor its martyrs, and General Soleimani is no exception, as the country also regards him as a martyr and a national hero. Now, on the second anniversary of Soleimani's assassination, Iranians have been using any chance to pay homage to him. These people say this is to preserve what Soleimani stood for. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his perfect progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Canon Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. As you have been following and listening such shows from IRIB English Radio, in this series of shows we are trying to talk about the questions and, let's say, the doubts and misconceptions that we are receiving from different questioners all around the world. For that, we have invited Islamic researcher and scholar Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary Schools to this show to help us to answer the questions. Before asking the first question, I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. Sheikh, the question of the day is concerning the difference between an idol and Kaaba. So why do we ask such a question? The question actually is rooted in the idea of idol worshipping. It is being said if worshipping of idols is forbidden, so necessarily the worshipping of Kaaba should be forbidden as well, because it is something made of stone and, let's say, it's kind of building. And idols also are, for example, can be made of stone and any other thing. So if we are asking people, or if we have been told and taught by Islamic teachings or, let's say, Allah's order that we are not allowed to worship idols, what is the difference between these two? So how can we differentiate between an idol and Kaaba? But one more question which is actually inside this question, and it's a great part of this question is focused at, is that are we really worshipping Kaaba or not? This is the question that I'm going to ask from you today.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. First of all, this is not idol worshipping, because worshipping idols, first of all, I think rationally is not acceptable. Mm-hmm. If you do not go to the text of the Noble Quran or the narrations of the Noble Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessing of Allah be upon them, mm-hmm. I think rationally speaking, it is not acceptable to worship stones and the idols and so on and so forth. And secondly, you see that there is a great difference between idol worshipping and going to the pilgrimage of Mecca, because worshipping idols means that you worship some specific stone or idols by the intention that it has a divine attribute. Mm-hmm. And, for example, that individual worships idols and that stone with the intention that a specific stone has some attribute, divine attributes, and can do something for him or her. For example, they believe some of the idol worshippers, they believe that they are, that specific idol is a, for example, creator of universe, or can do something and has some attributes, a divine attribute. Mm-hmm. And because of that, that individual worships and prostrate in front of that idol. Right. And this is a meaning of worshipping that idol. Mm-hmm. But going to Mecca is actually manifestation of unity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Mm-hmm. And it is because of that person wanted to be a real servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let me share one specific verse in this regard.
Please.
To see how there is a difference, and I do not see any similarity, and they are exactly in opposite side of each other.
So we do not worship Kaaba. We just, so what do we do when we go,
yes,
to perform Hajj then?
I just were going to elaborate on this point.
I would be grateful.
وَأَذِّنْ فِي النَّاسِ بِالْحَجِّ يَأْتُوكَ رِجَالًا وَعَلَى كُلِّ ضَامِرٍ يَأْتِينَ مِنْ كُلِّ فَجٍّ عَمِيقٍ لِيَشْهَدُوا مَنَافِئَ لَهُمْ وَيَذْكُرُوا اسْمَ اللَّهِ فِي أَيَّامٍ مَعْلُومَاتٍ. And proclaim the Hajj to all people. They will come to you on foot and lean camels, coming from distant places, that they may witness the benefits from them, the benefits for them. Mm-hmm. This is the first philosophy of Hajj, that they may witness the benefits for them and mention Allah's name during the known days.
Very true.
You see, the philosophy of Hajj is to witness the benefits for Hajj. It has many, many, you know, benefits for all people.
Very true.
And the first benefit of that is a unity of Islamic Ummah. Mm-hmm. They come together, they gather in one specific land, and they share their ideas, exchange ideas, and it is great manifestation of the unity of Islamic Ummah.
Yeah.
And of course, we see it has a lot of benefits for the people and for the Islamic Ummah. And another philosophy of Hajj is to mention the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So you see, when we go to Mecca, it is for the benefits of the remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And to show that we are servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and we want to worship Him. So it has nothing to do with idol worshipping. It is exactly on the opposite side of that. And it showed that we are servant of Allah and we want to mention Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let me share another narration. Imam Reza alayhi salatu wa salam, he said that وَأَلَى الْحَجْ الْوِفَادَةِ إِلَى اللَّهِ تَعَالَى وَالزِّيَادَةِ. He said that when you go to Mecca in order to do some pilgrimage, in that case, you have gone to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and you want to be guest of Allah. Mm-hmm. And ask Him and remember Him and وَالْخُرُوجْ مِنْ كُلِّ مَا مَقْتَرَفْ وَلَيَكُونَ تَائِبًا مُسْتَأْنِفًا لِمَا يَسْتَقْبِلْ. That person repents to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, ask forgiveness, and that she or he wanted to be away from that, you know, many sins and mistake and wrongdoing, yeah, that they done perhaps. وَالتَّقَرُّبْ بِالْعِبَادَةِ إِلَى اللَّهِ, and to get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَالْخُضُوْ وَالْإِسْتِكَانَةِ وَالْدُلْ شَاخِصًا إِلَيْهِ فِي الْحَرِّ وَالْبَارِ. Just you go toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and you want to show your humbleness, that you are a true servant of Allah. You see, I think it is very clear.
Yeah.
So far, it is very clear. The philosophy of Hajj is to show and to indicate your servitude to Allah subhanahu, mm-hmm, wa ta'ala, to remember Him and to show your humbleness towards Him. So it has nothing to do with idol worshiping.
So what is being done there actually is not going to do anything with the place itself, let's say, I mean with the stones or with the building itself, rather than it's a building, it's a token for worshiping Allah in a certain, let's say, time and place.
Exactly. Because the philosophy of Hajj, because you know that going to Hajj is a particular ibadah and worshipping of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the worship should be in a way and in a form that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala indicated to us.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
One of the reasons that this or such questions can come to the minds of the questioners is that they see that Muslims stand in front of the door of Kaaba and they pray. It seems as if they are asking this building to give them their, let's say, their needs and to actually answer their supplications. So are the Muslims really doing so? I mean, they are asking this Kaaba, this building, to give them something, or no, they are addressing God.
You see, when they show the humbleness toward that specific, it shows to be, you know, it seems to be in this way, toward that specific building, it does not have the intention, that intention of the worshipping of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Right. As I said, worshipping has two character and two attributes. First of all, your action, your humbleness, and second is, maybe it is more important, is in the intention inside that action. And when you do that action without the intention of worshipping of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, actually you have prostrated in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, okay? And your intention is that I believe that there is a great creator of the universe who is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I believe in the unity of Allah and all the divine attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But I prostrate in front of that, you know, building in order to show my servitude toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So it does not have the, you know, quality of worshipping, and it is not actually worshipping to that building or, for example, mosque and things.
But on the contrary, when it comes for the idols, the people who are actually worshipping idols, they are waiting for a response from the side of the idol. That is, their needs are going to they are expecting their needs to be fulfilled. But Muslims do not expect such a thing from Kaaba. Am I right? I mean, is it the key difference between these two?
Exactly. When some people, that idol worshippers, they go and prostrate and bow down toward that, you know, in front of that idol, they believe that that idol can do something for them, and it has a divine attributes. Unfortunately, as I said, it is not rationally acceptable. Yeah. And, you know, they have this belief that that idol is their god. Okay?
True.
And they had some attribute, and they can do something for them. But for the going to the Mecca and prostrating in front of the, for example, that building, it is actually prostration toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because the only, divine attribute, the only God, is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because we believe in that there is no God but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and the famous witness that la ilaha illallah.
Yeah. So one last question I want you to be brief in answer, if you don't mind, Sheikhna. So why do you go to Hajj, why do you go to Saudi Arabia to just perform such an action in front of Kaaba? Why don't you do it here? As you say that the God is not visible, then does God have a house? And this house, I mean, he is residing in that house? What is it like? So why do you go there to perform this action? So why don't you do it from here?
First of all, God does not have any house. When we say Baytullah, it is some kind of, we call it some kind of magnitude and some kind of respect toward the host, that specific host. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has specified that place to be a, you know, token and the sign.